This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's called the opt-out movement, a small but growing effort in many states against standardized tests. It's especially big in New York, Colorado, and a handful of others where rising percentages of students, with their parents' backing, refuse to take any test associated with national standards like Common Core. The opt-out movement also has supporters in the Granite State, including sponsors of a measure House lawmakers will vote on today. House Bill 1338 would allow students to skip the assessment test without penalty and would not allow the state to punish local districts for low student participation rates. In general, the anti-test sentiment centers around a few key themes: that the tests don't really measure what kids know, that they take up too much valuable time, and that they're unfairly used to penalize schools and teachers. But standardized testing does have its supporters, among them U.S. business leaders who've long worried about the patchwork nature of American education. Also, some civil rights groups who feel the tests hold schools accountable to do right by minority kids, and many governors, including New Hampshire's Maggie Hassan. Last year, the governor vetoed an opt-out measure similar to the current bill, saying these tests provide the only statewide snapshot as to how our public schools are performing. Today in The Exchange, getting testy over standardized tests. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Should students be allowed to opt out of these tests? What do you see as the benefits and drawbacks of these assessments? Again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Our guest for the hour is Andrew Ujifusa. He's assistant editor for Education Week. That's a national publication. He covers education policy at the federal level and writes for the Politics K-12 blog. And Andrew, welcome back. It's great to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And also with us for the hour, we'll be checking in with other Granite Staters working on this issue, including the sponsor of the opt-out bill that I mentioned. But before we get to that, Andrew, just remind us, this opt-out movement, opt-out of what?
So the opt-out movement, which, you know, you mentioned in your introduction, is resistance to have parents having their children take standardized tests. Virtually all of the opt-out movement focuses on tests associated with the Common Core state standards. Most of those tests were given for the first time in the 2014-15 school year. So last spring, about a year ago, was the first time that the opt-out movement really got going, and it's motivated by several concerns, and it's going to be interesting to see to what extent the momentum behind the movement keeps going or grows this year.
So this got started, though, right, Andrew, with No Child Left Behind, President Bush's signature, domestic achievement, his education law. I mean, people have been complaining about standardized tests and feeling like they're over the top for, gosh, since the early 2000s with No Child Left Behind.
Yes, that law was signed by President George W. Bush in 2002, and it sort of ushered in a new era of standardized tests. And in fact, the new federal education law that President Barack Obama signed in December continues the basic testing regimen of No Child Left Behind. States have to test students in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school, once a year in English, language, arts, and math. So that regimen has not changed. The new law that Obama signed gives states a bit more flexibility in some areas of testing, but the basic landscape of when students have to take tests And English language arts and math has not changed.
So, again, these are the statewide assessments that are then reported to the federal government. This isn't allowing your 10th grader to skip his algebra test because he didn't study.
Right. And keep in mind, these are state tests that the federal government is concerned with. They're required by Washington, but they're not federal tests per se. The states pick, develop their own state tests to satisfy the requirements under federal law.
And if states, the threat, Andrew, right, is that if you don't have enough kids participating or if you do really poorly, you lose some federal funding?
Yes. The feds are very concerned with participation rates. And in fact, in December, 13 states received letters from the U.S. Department of Education notifying them that the data the states reported indicated that either in some districts or with certain subgroups of students or students statewide, those states did not meet or districts in their state did not meet the 95% participation requirement from the feds. And the penalty for that potentially is that states might lose some federal funding. I think states are still trying to work out sort of the landscape of that and what happened, but Washington has notified states where they've seen issues with test participation.
Well, and speaking of the landscape, Andrew, New York seems to be the center of opposition to standardized testing this time around. What's happening there?
Well, I think the opt-out movement in New York, as you say, is the most powerful one, the most influential one, and it really has its roots in 2013. New York gave tests aligned to the Common Core state standards earlier than most states, and there was a significant change in the share of students who were judged to be proficient on the tests. And when those scores were released, I believe in late summer of 2013, there was a significant backlash from a variety of groups. They were also upset about the state's shift to the Common Core, how it was handled. Simultaneously, there were shifts to the new teacher evaluations in the state. And since then, it's become very unsettled in terms of sort of those three moving parts of education policy. Last spring, actually, the State Teachers Union even endorsed the opt-out movement and encouraged parents to opt their kids out of the test, which was an unusual move in sort of state education politics.
Yeah, so the upset wasn't just about the test itself and, you know, how good it is or not good, but how it's used, how those results are used.
Yes, I think that's right. And teachers felt as though, some teachers, I should say, felt as though they were not really involved, sort of engaged by the state when the state was shifting to the standards and shifting to a new curriculum that was aligned to the standards. There were a variety of sources for the upset, one might say. But it does appear as if opt-out is going to be an issue again in New York State this year. As you mentioned, it was an issue in a few other states. It'll be interesting to see if the number of the states experiencing opt-out as a significant movement grows.
Well, joining us now, Andrew, on the phone is J.R. Hole, Republican state representative from Dunbarton. And the New Hampshire House today will vote on his bill allowing students to opt out of assessment tests without penalty. The bill also, by the way, forbids the state from penalizing districts who have low test participation rates. Representative Hole, good to have you. Welcome back to The Exchange.
Thank you. Good morning.
What is your objection, Representative Hole, to statewide assessments?
So there's many objections, one of which is I don't know that this benefits directly the students themselves. Ultimately, statewide assessments are used to judge the quality of a school system as opposed to, and potentially a teacher, but they're not used anymore to actually find out what the student knows and doesn't know to directly benefit the student. And that's contrary to our own stated statutes. And as you and Andrew were just speaking, right, teachers are supposed to be involved in designing and using the assessment system, and that's in RSA 190-C, Roman numeral 3, or colon 3. So we're seeing state assessments that are not used the way parents want them. They're not helping their children learn. And all it is about control of the finances that are sent to the various school systems.
So it's used to judge the quality of a school system and a teacher, not the student and what he or she is learning. Is it worth, Representative Hole, getting a snapshot, as Governor Hassan said when she vetoed the bill last time, getting a snapshot of the quality of that school system, of the teachers in that system?
It would be fine if the snapshot was done well. So here's some of the issues. The students, it's not used, let's say the upper elementary or high school level assessments, let's say the eighth grade one, for instance, the students really just don't care. They don't want to be there that test day. They know it doesn't affect their score. They don't bother to answer the questions well. They don't put any time or effort into it.
Yeah, we've
and
heard
therefore,
that.
There's a real unintended consequence because they're not used to judge what the student actually knows, and therefore it takes time out of the classroom. The students just randomly put down dots on some of these sheets or on the type in random answers in some of the computer programs, and then all of a sudden we have faulty data. We're making education choices about funding on bad data. That's not what's in the best interest of either the students, the teachers, or the school system.
What's a substitute then, Representative Hole, to, again, use that well-worn phrase, hold schools accountable, if not through these types of tests?
So, I mean, traditionally, well, at least when I was in school, teachers themselves were helping design the tests and all the way through college. Today, unfortunately, we're kind of asking teachers to be facilitators. Can you take this test? And I don't want to do that to the teachers. They put a lot of time and effort into learning to teach. They have a passion about instructing students. Let's let them be teachers, and part of that would be designing the test themselves so they can actually judge whether the students are learning or not in their classroom.
So would you, Representative Hole, just get rid of these tests entirely, these statewide assessments?
I would definitely move in the direction of scaling them back. There was some article I read recently that over a student's lifetime from K through 12, or first grade through 12, they see something like 193 statewide assessments. And some of these assessments are done multiple times in a year. That's a lot of testing. And we've heard that teachers teach to the tests. And I guess the root cause of all of this is, why is there such a strong push to standardize tests? And there was a great article in the Washington Post that a while ago, and it was quoting, it was talking about this, and part of the reason is the drive for the money, right? An NHPR reporter, Anya Kamitz, I guess, was quoted in this, and she said, follow the money. Companies that publish the tests make lots of money. So at the end of the day, the groups that are pushing these tests, it's not about whether the students are doing better or not. It is used to judge school and help make decisions on curriculum, but it really comes down to the money-making system for certain large publishers of education materials.
So private financial interests, private companies that do the tests and then create the curriculum behind those tests, you're saying this is really a push by them to make money?
That's right.
I have an email here I'd love to share with you, Representative Hole. This is from Suzanne, who says, we opted our kids out of the Smarter Balance test when we read the comments by Nashua teachers about how bad they were. Suzanne says, from that point on, we've read and heard enough from teachers to realize these tests are not good measurement tools when it comes to measuring their academic knowledge. We don't like that it's gathering data on our kids and sharing this with government entities. We don't like that it's not the old achievement tests that we took when we were children. The Nashua teachers said that these were more like psychological evaluations. Suzanne says, we don't oppose testing, but we want an authentic test of knowledge, and this is not what we are getting. Thank you, Suzanne, for the email. And I sort of asked you this already, Representative Hole, but I'll ask you again. So, again, what would be that authentic test of knowledge
I think we're back to the teacher helping craft the math test, who's teaching algebra. Right, knows what they have just covered, knows what they need to verify that the students have learned or not learned, right? So let the teacher create the assessment. So when we talk about assessments, we're not typically talking about whether the students have learned the academic material in the test that was taken in the classroom. These are used purely to judge the quality of the school system. And we're seeing violations of state law in another section where teachers and parents and others should have access to the material and to be able to see their students' individual test scores and the answers and the test, and they're not. And that's a real problem going forward with some of these computerized test systems.
Representative Hull, one of the concerns that has come up and that was behind the creation of Common Core by education officials in the states, not from the federal government, was that when states were adopting their own assessment tests, when districts were creating their own assessment tests, as you suggest, they were making it too easy, that there's this sort of patchwork of education standards around the country, that a high school degree from a school in Kentucky means something very different than a high school degree from a school in New Hampshire. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and other business groups have said, look, we need some standardization so that we know what we're getting. I wonder what you think.
So there's merit at some level, especially given the mobility of people today, right? Jobs change, right? People are transferred or they pick up and move to another state. That somebody learning at the sixth grade level in New Hampshire needs to be close to the level in Kentucky, for instance, right, in terms of the material being covered. I understand that goal. We're not a static society. But I also understand that we should let the teachers have a greater say in what's going on in terms of making sure the students are learning. I don't think the current paradigm in terms of these standardized assessments where there's no motivation from the students to actually demonstrate what they've learned are a good measure at all, or a good metric of evaluating school systems, materials, teachers, anything. And by the time you get to the upper levels of these tests, the students just don't want to be bothered.
Well, Representative Hull, as I said earlier, your bill is being voted on by the full House today. What do you think is going to happen?
So for the listener's sake, right, a bill very similar to this was introduced last year and then ended up verbatim with what's being discussed today, and then the governor did, in fact, veto it last summer.
So it passed the legislature?
It passed the legislature in the form that it is in, that it's going through the House today. The veto override failed in the House by 22 people, 24 people, I don't remember, or 24 votes, right, in a day that we were 60 members shy of the full House. So I don't know what happened. I mean, I expect that it will pass today on the House floor, go through the Senate. The question is, if the governor chooses to veto again, what happens on a veto override?
Okay. Well, Representative Hull, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
That's J.R. Hull, Republican representative from Dunbarton. As we heard, the House is voting today on his bill allowing students to opt out of assessment tests without penalty. The number for you to join us here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And real quick, Andrew Ujifusa, are there lots of states like New Hampshire where lawmakers are saying, look, don't penalize students who opt out and don't penalize districts who have low participation rates?
I wouldn't say there's a huge number. There was one notable state last year that passed a opt-out bill similar to what the representative is proposing. That was Oregon. I should note that the new federal law, while it does require participation in state assessments, it also allows states to pass opt-out laws like the one that Oregon passed. So some folks are seeing sort of an inherent conflict between those two statutes, if you will, one at the federal level and one that states could pass. But there is a lot of pressure on states from the federal government to have students participate in tests. I should also point out that the federal government, as well as many civil rights groups, think that these tests are part of a broader responsibility that schools have to the public, to the business community, and to the country to accurately show student performance and also to make sure that we're touching on and highlighting and addressing the student performance of those most disadvantaged kids.
Hence the name of the bill, No Child Left Behind, from President Bush years back. We're going to take a very quick break, Andrew. When we come back, more on the opt-out movement, and we'll hear from you, so stay with us. The This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, increasing testiness about standardized tests. We're looking at what's being called the opt-out movement, parents refusing to allow their children to take standardized tests. Looking at what that means for schools and students and districts, 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. Should students be allowed to opt out of these tests? What are the benefits of these statewide assessments? What are some of the drawbacks as you see it? Again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. This hour, in addition to hearing from some New Hampshire voices involved in this issue, we're talking with Andrew Ujifusa, assistant editor for Education Week. He covers education policy at the federal level and writes for the Politics K-12 blog. And Andrew, let's go right to our listeners. And Chris is calling from Nashua. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange. Welcome.
Hey, both. Yet another wonderful show.
Thanks, Chris. Go ahead.
My point is this, or I have several points on this. The first is that I think there's a conspiracy of vested interest to make sure that we just don't hold anybody accountable. We have parents who are concerned that their students might not be the, you know, amazing prodigies that they want them to be. They certainly don't want to have their schools be labeled as failing schools. Teachers, understandably, don't want to be held responsible for a whole grab bag of socioeconomic factors beyond which, you know, they have no control. Which I understand, but at the end of the day, you know, you have to produce results for all this money that we're spending. The other thing is that politicians understandably don't want it highlighted very clearly and objectively that they have some serious equity funding problems in their schools and that they have a responsibility to help minority communities. I'm sure you're going to bring that up. The second thing I wanted to address is that the Republican politician, I feel, is giving a grab bag of excuses for why we shouldn't do this. I went to high school in New York State where we had the Regents exams, and those were, you know, decent, very reasonable exams. And I know that the way we dealt with that issue of people not trying is basically there's peer pressure. Nobody wanted to be labeled an idiot. So, you know, everybody compared scores. It was, you know, it was a very competitive public high school that I went to, and we didn't have a problem with people just, you know, putting dots on a page. It doesn't sound like a reasonable objection.
So a conspiracy of interests against standardized testing. Parents, teachers, politicians who you say, Chris, don't want to fund public schools. J.R. Hole mentioned another type of conspiracy, and I've heard others say it too, Chris, that there are private interests who are really enjoying getting paid for writing these tests and coming up with them and creating curriculum around them. I wonder what you think about that, Chris.
That's like accusing publishers for making books. I mean, it's somebody's going to have to do it. If it's not a private company doing it, it's going to have to be a government entity or, you know, something like that, or a nonprofit entity. And, you know, that's an objection you can easily get around. If you want to, we can certainly create a nonprofit or a government entity to do that. I would also say for a lot of these people who object to standardized testing, especially when it comes to like the math and sciences, we are way behind a lot of the industrialized world.
Okay. Well, Chris, thank you for calling in. Yeah, I want to let you go for a second because I do want to hear from our guest, and then we are going to bring in Tom Raffio with the State Board of Education. Andrew, I'd love to hear your thoughts on these sort of competing interests. And Chris mentioned what he called a conspiracy of interests against standardized tests. Who is in this opt-out movement? What kind of people?
Well, I think conspiracy is kind of a loaded word, but there are certainly sort of several interests that are a part of the opt-out movement. As I mentioned, in New York, at least, the state teachers union supports the opt-out movement. I think other state teachers unions may not have gone as far as the New York State Union, but I think they've been very critical of recent rollout of standardized tests and the way tests are used in some cases. There are concerned parents, I think that's the other big voice you hear, who think that, the debate, part of the debate is over whether these tests are in fact an objective measure of student performance and whether it's worth sacrificing learning time, classroom time to these tests. And some people think these tests are useful and have a broad and important public policy use, but some parents believe that these are not objective measures, that the measurement itself is flawed. And they also don't think that these tests, while they may serve a public policy purpose, aren't particularly helpful to their children. And I think in particular you've seen high school opt-out rates in a few states particularly high. And I think that sort of reflects student as well as parent belief that, you know, as they get closer to leaving public school, there are other tests that are more important than these.
What's the parental demographic involved in this movement, Andrew? I have read that a lot of the opt-out folks are, not my words here, white soccer moms, whereas some of the parents who favor standardized testing tend to be minority parents who, you know, say, yeah, thank you for holding my school accountable for doing right by my kid. What are the racial or economic demographics involved in this?
So I think to a certain extent there's some evidence for that. I want to be careful in terms of painting the opt-out movement with a broad brush in terms of race or class. I think if you look at a few states, like New York and like New Jersey, which also had a relatively vigorous opt-out movement, as well as what happened in Colorado, you do see some evidence that a large share of parents opting their kids out of these state tests do come from relatively wealthy backgrounds. There are some leaders in the opt-out movement who are not white, who are minority folks who believe these tests are damaging their schools and are used to punish schools with, you know, large shares of minority and low-income students. So I don't know if it's as black and white as anybody wants to paint it, but I do think there is some of that, you know, suburban parents, many of them white, do in many cases feel as if the tests are not particularly important for their kids. The other side of that coin is people say, well, you may be exercising that choice for your child, but when you do that, you hurt the entire school that your child attends and other students, many of whom may not have the advantages that your child has. So those are two sort of competing arguments.
Well, Andrew, I want to bring another Granite State voice into our conversation. With us now on the line is Tom Raffio, chairman of the State Board of Education. And Tom Raffio, welcome to The Exchange. Thanks for taking time out.
Thank you, and good morning, Laura. Glad to be here.
Well, what's your response, Tom, to this intense dislike of testing that we're seeing, prompting rising numbers of parents around the country to refuse to allow their children to take these tests?
Well, I have four children, and they all were stressed out as well on testing and things like that, but that we know we have to do an annual assessment to make sure that our schools are providing an adequate education. But more importantly, as a parent, I wanted to see how my kids were doing, so I'll be the first one to acknowledge that we as parents get concerned when our kids seem to be concerned about testing. But I think it is a very important part of our educational process, and the State Board and the department has been really good at understanding that. So we're moving into a new realm called PACE. I don't know if that's been discussed today, but it's called Performance Assessment for Competency Education, where we're doing less testing for those schools that have opted into this this pilot program. And if you're a PACE school, you now just get tested, you know, twice, once in elementary and once in middle school. And we've heard the concern. So, for example, and I did listen to the representative on the terms of when you get into high school, the kids are just not really taking the test serious.
But yeah, they know it doesn't count, right.
Well, but recognizing that, we've moved to the 11th grade testing is now going to be the SAT. And the advantage of that is, of course, parents who couldn't necessarily maybe afford to have paid for the SAT test, their child will now have an opportunity to use that SAT also to get into college or university, those that still require the SAT. So the 11th graders will, in fact, take the test, you know, seriously. So I think it's a necessary part of we need to affirm that we're providing an adequate education. So you as a taxpayer need to know that. But just as importantly, a parent needs to know, you know, where their child is. And we actually get those results, and teachers take it seriously and adjust their, you know, ultimately will be adjusting their lesson plans accordingly. So it is part of the process, and we're recognizing, though, that there is this perception of too much testing, which is why we're trying to move more and more schools to the PACE process.
Well, a couple of things to follow up on, Tom. You said it's very important, these tests, part of our educational process, because it helps you know, it helps teachers know, helps parents know, helps kids know where they're at. We heard from Representative Hull earlier, and we've heard from other people who say, actually, these tests don't help you know, that they're flawed, that they're not created locally, that they're standardized, just the whole host of issues that some folks have with standardized tests that they really don't give you a good gauge. I wonder what you think.
Well, that's their opinion. I think they actually do a really good job. We have we know where students are, English, language arts, and mathematics, and, of course, with the whole focus on STEM or STEAM, we need to that. I think people do recognize that we are falling behind, you know, internationally on math and science. And I actually think it does a great job. And despite all the noise surrounding it, as you, I think, have been know, we had about a 95% participation rate in New Hampshire despite all the noise. And it was even higher, except for 11th grade, that it was less than 90%. So I think it does actually a great job for the teachers, for the parents to know where their child is, and also for the school districts and for the taxpayers to know, are we doing an adequate education? And we have, by state law, we have that ultimate responsibility to make sure each child gets educated.
You mentioned the SAT and how that could be used as an assessment for juniors instead of the other tests. Here's an email that came in, Tom, from Ray that I would love to share with you. Ray says, a few weeks ago, the junior class at New Hampshire High Schools were administered the SAT. The SATs were selected by the State Board of Education as an assessment vehicle to measure academic progress. Ray says the State Board of Education was negligent and derelict in this selection. The SATs were never developed to be an assessment tool. The test was developed to aid college and university admissions committees to determine if an applicant would be successful in college. Ray says the SATs have not done a good job. Many universities no longer require the test or make it optional. The SATs predict family income. The higher the SAT score, the higher the family income. Ray concludes by saying the state should use its resources to develop an assessment measure that relates to New Hampshire. So lots of concerns about using the SAT, Tom, as an assessment tool. What do you think?
Well, I'll have to respectfully disagree with Ray. We actually spent a ton of time on this and balancing out what would be the best test for the 11th grader, so one, that they take it seriously. Two, we also know that affordability of taking the test has been a glass ceiling for some people that can't afford it. So we looked at this, we studied this for the year, and then the final analysis, taking this as the SAT instead of the balance assessment was definitely the way to go, and it kills two birds with one stone. It gives children who may not have had the ability to take the test before the opportunity to get into college and universities. Yes, some colleges and universities don't require the SATs, but many do, and I think we have actually the best of both worlds. And we do everything thoughtfully, so there's no dereliction of duty. In fact, just the opposite. We spend a ton of time on this to make sure that we selected the right test. And also by pushing the PACE pilot, we're actually doing a lot less testing. So it actually gets into some of the conversation that I've heard, which is testing that's more specific to the curriculum at the different schools. And we have some great feedback from the schools, Sauhegan, Rochester, Pittsfield, and so forth.
Just a couple schools are involved in this pilot so far, though, right? Yeah.
Well, we have Sanborn, Rochester, Epping, Sauhegan, Concord, Pittsfield, Seacoast Charter, and Monroe School. And basically, I'll just sum it up by one Sauhegan student who emailed us saying, PACE allows students to be creative, expand their thinking, and even have more fun with it. So the point is, we do recognize some of the points that I've heard in today's show, and I think more and more as schools adopt the PACE, we will have the balance of still having the necessary assessment so taxpayers and parents know how their kids are doing, but also that there are tests that are more focused on the curriculum and much more specific to New Hampshire and those local school districts.
One more question for you, please, Tom, sure. And then I'll let you go. Part of J.R. Hole's bill, again, says students won't be penalized if they opt out. It also says that the state cannot penalize local school districts if they have low student participation rates. What is the state board's role in making sure districts keep up with the federal requirements? How much pull and power do you guys have?
Well, we monitor this. We have the statistics. I mean, we know that, for example, this last cycle, 98% of the third graders participated, and we have all the results. And just for the record, I in terms of the representative's bill, so parents realize this, that there are already in state law specific exemptions. So if there's a death in the family, if there's a medical emergency, if there's some severe emotional distress. So there are current ways. The law is totally unnecessary, and it will be vetoed again should it happen to pass. So, yeah, we monitor this, and we need to have, as one of the callers said, you need to have most of students taking the test so we can see how the school district is doing in terms of education. You can't have, you know, parents willy-nilly opting out. But just so everybody realizes, there are legitimate ways that you can be exempted, and I've referenced a few of them.
If a particular district, you know, this movement really caught on in a particular district, Tom, and, you know, 75% of kids opted out or 50% or whatever, does the state board have any power to penalize that district, to bring that district back into line?
I like to look at it as more proactive, which is we're trying to get more and more school districts and towns to adopt PACE. That's a real hypothetical question. If we already had last year, despite all the noise, 95%, it's a problem we would look into it, but we would try to, no pun intended, try to do it via an educational process, that it's important that the kids take it so parents know how their kid is doing, and also for an 11th grader, so maybe, you know, he or she can get into the college of their choice.
Okay. Tom, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure, and thank you for this great opportunity, Laura. And it's a great show, by the way. Thank you.
Tom Raffio, chairman of the State Board of Education. Again, the exchange number for you to join us as we wade through some of the issues surrounding assessment tests and some of the pushback against them is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. With us for the hour is Andrew Ujifusa, assistant editor for Education Week, covering education policy at the federal level. And Andrew, Tom Raffio mentioned PACE a couple times. Again, this is a pilot project in about half a dozen districts around the state where testing is scaled back. Other assessments are used. One student, Tom quoted, even said it was fun. What do you know about districts trying to find ways to reach middle ground with parents and students?
So I will say I've actually had the privilege of visiting several New Hampshire schools that are participating in the PACE pilot. I actually visited last November, and I think there is a great deal of excitement in those schools about these formative assessments. They're sort of tests that are not summative, but they're so you don't sit down in the spring and take it once. It's sort of an ongoing test, if you will. It's difficult to describe, but essentially it's assessment that's not a test. And the schools are excited about it. I will say that the one big concern that people have about it is that it is very difficult to scale up. It's important to remember the standardized and standardized assessment. Teachers are developing these in collaboration at the local level, but the question a lot of folks have is how do you make it so that you sort of grow these to the point where they can be used sort of on a statewide basis. It's not easy, and I think even the fans of PACE and formative assessments admit that. New Hampshire has
been working on
this. How do
you ramp it up? And Andrew, I got to jump in on you, but we will pick it up in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're learning more about the opt-out movement around the country, parents refusing to have their children take standardized tests, especially those associated with Common Core. We're looking at what that means for schools and students and hearing about an effort here in New Hampshire to allow students to opt out without penalty. and to forbid the state from punishing districts who have low test participation rates. Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you this hour. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. What do you think? Should students be allowed to opt out of these tests? What do you see as some of the benefits of these assessments? How about some of the drawbacks? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. With us for the hour, Andrew Ujifusa, Assistant Editor for Education Week. And Andrew, a couple more questions for you. We were talking about who has been pushing this opt-out movement and learning that it's a diverse set of folks. How about on Capitol Hill, Andrew? What are the politics right now of, you know, assessments, given the strong pushback that we've seen in some states like New York, like Florida?
Well, as I mentioned towards the top of the hour, there was discussion at the federal level about the extent to which when folks are talking about renewing federal education law, what do we do about testing requirements? There were serious discussions about should we change it, but the federal education law that was signed in December by President Obama does keep NCLB's standardized testing regimen. So there's no change there in terms of these standardized tests that are causing controversy. There is a bit more flexibility for high schools in terms of choosing assessments to use. Chairman of the State Board mentioned the SAT. That's not without its complications in terms of picking tests like the ACT and SAT, which states and schools are exploring using under the new law. There is a question as to whether those tests are, you know, not the best ones to use in terms of assessing student performance in high school, given that they were originally designed, as you know, as a college entrance exam. So there are debates about the wisdom of making that switch in some schools. So I would say that there was a brief sort of opt-out and opt-out-related push on the Hill last year, but it didn't ultimately get traction, really, in the new federal education law.
And again, that new federal education law, Andrew, is that the Every Student Succeeds Act, the ESSA, that people are talking about?
Yes, ESSA. There's a vigorous debate as to how you would pronounce that. Some people say ESSA. We say ESSA.
Uh-huh.
These are the kind of fascinating debates we have in Washington. No, it is the Every Student Succeeds Act, and was a product of months of negotiations on Capitol Hill. Initially, I should say, for a time, it looked as though maybe it had stalled out. There were previous attempts, I believe, in 2011 and 2013. It was supposed to have been reauthorized 7 to 8 years ago, but they got a little behind schedule. So I think there was a sense of urgency among various Washington officials that this was the time to get it over the line for a variety of reasons.
It sounds like, from what you said, Andrew, that this ESSA is kind of like No Child Left Behind, but just with a little more flexibility and a new name.
Well, I think that would be off the market in a general sense. I think that the major change in ESSA is that essentially it gives significantly more sort of policymaking decisions to states and local school districts. That's separate from the testing requirements, which remain. But in terms of how test scores are used and how states intervene in struggling schools, academic goals that they set. Your listeners may be familiar with adequate yearly progress, AYP, under No Child Left Behind. That is gone. States no longer have to sort of hew to that. So there is more flexibility and more control for states and for districts under ESSA. The question that still, you know, needs to be answered is, how are they going to use it, and how are states going to use that power differently from state to state?
Well, I want to bring in a local voice to our conversation, Andrew, and Mark Conrad's on the line with us. He's the superintendent of the Nashua School District. And, Mark, thank you very much for giving us your time this morning.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What's been happening in Nashua around this opt-out movement?
Well, so that became a significant source of discussion with our Board of Education last year, and there was concern on our board that the voices of parents who had concerns about the Smarter Balance assessments be heard, and concerns that there be no penalty for students and as administrators and teachers, we certainly agreed with assuring there was no penalty on students. So our board pursued a motion of saying, in essence, there will be no penalty for students. They will have excused absences if they're out that day, or we will endeavor to find alternative activities for those students. And we saw some interesting results from that. If we look at grades 3 through 7 in our district last year, we had participation rates around the 95% level. But when we got to 8th grade, it fell to just above 80%. And when we got to our high school in grade 11, it actually fell a little bit below half. And so we saw some real impacts from the desire of parents and students to opt out of those assessments.
Yeah, that's a pretty stunning headline. About half of juniors in Nashua opt out of this test. What does that mean for Nashua vis-a-vis the federal government? I mean, the federal government wants you guys to do this and will withhold money if you don't.
Well, we've never really heard articulated to us what the impact would be for not meeting that participation rate. And I think even now, if you look at the new Every Student Succeeds Act, it does give more policy options at the local and state level for opt-out provisions, but then it also says the state has to meet the 95% rate, but nobody's quite sure what happens if you don't. I think the real important issue here is, if we're going to have an accountability system, and I think it's important to have that, it needs to be a system that's viewed as having educational value for teachers and for students. You know, we don't want to be in this position where we're constantly in controversy with groups of parents, or where teachers feel or students feel we're wasting their time in the classroom. We provide here, for example, in Nashua, we use a benchmark assessment system in addition to Smarter Balance that enables us to track student growth and provides immediate results to teachers on student outcomes from the assessment, so they can use that the same day to say, what do I need to do differently in the classroom as I'm looking at the results for individual students?
Because that's the goal, right, Mark, is to say, okay, is this kid having a problem with his French verbs? All right, let's fix that.
Well, I think there are multiple levels of goals. So the purpose of an accountability assessment system is really to help schools and districts understand how well they're doing with their students in making sure their students are meeting the standards. But there's also that goal of understanding student growth and not simply looking at proficiency at a point in time. And to do that, you really have to have periodic testing periods so you can measure growth from one testing period to the next. So with our benchmark assessment system, we provide an assessment at the beginning of the year, and we use that information on a regular basis. For example, I can walk around our schools in October and I see teachers poring over that information from a test that's just been given to say, how do I establish skills groups in my classrooms if they have multiple levels of skills grouping in reading and math? We just finished our mid-year benchmark assessing, so we can look at that mid-year growth for students and say, is there something we need to be doing differently for individual students to accelerate their growth? And then we'll provide a final testing period at the end of the year to say, what was the growth of this student over the course of the year, and what does that mean as we think about providing information to teachers for the next year as they think about their classrooms.
Well, so this is a different description of the test that we get from opponents, Mark. The tests you're describing are highly relevant and highly useful in the classroom.
We think they are, and they're third-party tests. So we use a testing system called iReady, but there are others out there on the market, and they tend to be normative assessments based on large number of millions of students who may be taking the assessment. So from that, they can determine the kinds of growth we should be seeing in our students. And what it's helped us to do, which I think is a fault of some of the accountability assessments, is get beyond the question of who's proficient to look deeper at the question of how are students growing.
What does that mean, normative, by the way?
Normative means they're looking at performance within the group of students to say, what could we expect looking at 2 million students, for example, as opposed to saying, what is their growth rate towards the standards itself.
Here's an email that came in from Bill, and this is in response to an earlier email we got from Ray. Ray taking issue with New Hampshire high schools using the SAT as a tool of assessment. Bill says virtually all New Hampshire superintendents communicated to the State Board of Education that they wanted to move to the SAT. Are you using the SAT as an assessment tool in Nashua for high school kids, Mark?
We are, and in fact, I was in the room multiple times when the commissioner sought feedback, and there was a real sense that we wanted to move towards the SAT because it's viewed as a relevant test because so many of our students know they understand the role of the SAT in the college application process. I'll give you an example of how we've used a similar test. So we started providing the PSAT to every 10th grade student in Nashua 4 years ago and started looking at those outcomes. And one example of how we've used that test is in 10th grade, we looked at students who might not typically think of themselves as college-bound or even thinking of themselves as students who were able to do more advanced work. And we identified those students who we could focus on to say, you can be successful in advanced placement courses. And so we've seen an increase in some underserved groups of students taking advanced placement courses because of the results we saw on the PSAT. And I think as you look at the SAT, you may have students who would never have thought they could be prepared for college or could see that in their future who are taking that test and looking at the results and saying, gee, maybe I really can do this work.
Oh, so Mark, one last question for you, please, and then we'll let you go. So you mentioned that 45%, I think you said participation rate, or 45% opt-out rate. Among high school kids in Nashua, just saying, nah, I'm not going to take these assessment tests. What are you going to do about that? I mean, I'm guessing that can't.
So as we looked, so last year we had fewer than half our students take the Smarter Balanced at grade 11. This year, on the first day of our SAT testing, we had an attendance rate of better than 90% for our juniors, and we haven't even taken the makeups yet. So we'll have a participation rate into the 90% range, again, because they see the test as relevant. And it also recognizes, particularly in this district where we have a strong advanced placement program, our juniors are taking advanced placement tests at the same time. There's the science kneecap assessment, and they may have already been planning on taking the SAT. So this just, because it had relevance to them, we're finding high participation rates.
Okay. Well, Mark, thank you very much for being with us.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. That's Mark Conrad, again, superintendent of the Nashua School District. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. A couple emails. Here's one from Brennan who says, a big concern with students opting out of standardized tests at younger ages is college access. He says, as long as testing remains a necessary evil of the college admissions process, for many schools, we are disadvantaging children if we don't give him exposure to these tests. He says many colleges and universities still use standardized testing to assess applicants and to determine merit scholarships. Brennan says we, as a state, have adopted the SAT for all juniors, and if students are opting out, it could limit their opportunities. He says, I am all for doing away with standardized testing as an assessment tool, but it has to start from the top down. So that's an email from Brennan. Let's go to the phones, and Alex joins us from Ossipee. Hi, Alex. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a general statement about SAT. I think overall, as a test, it does a great job of measuring someone's academic achievements and aptitude. The one part of the test that I take exception to is the vocabulary section of the test. It is full of words that have not been used in the modern English language probably for at least 100-plus years. And it forces, you know, unnecessary memorization of these truly archaic words that are there in Webster Dictionary, but will have no practical use or implication to our children in their future going forward. I just think that that's unnecessary and can be replaced with more interesting sections that truly measure someone's learning aptitude or intellectual abilities, rather than, you know, brutal memorization of dictionary that has long gone.
You know, Alex, thank you for the comment. I want to ask you something, if I could. I have read that concerns that we are dumbing down our beautiful language, that there are so many words that people used to use, as you say, you know, 100 years ago. They're great words. They're expressive. They focus in on a particular feeling or thought or concept. And that our language has gotten less interesting because we don't use those words as much. I wonder what you think about that, Alex. And actually, it looks like we lost him. So we'll leave that question there for the moment. Andrew Ujifusa, we're getting a lot of pushback from our listeners on this idea of the SAT. I've got a couple emails here that I don't have time to read. But people don't seem to like the option of using the SAT as an assessment tool. I wonder what you think, Andrew.
Concern about that. As a couple of folks have mentioned, I think part of the idea, and this is not exclusive to New Hampshire, I think part of the idea for states is that using the SAT as the assessment, for high schoolers is to increase participation, particularly in places like New Hampshire. And I believe this also occurred in Connecticut, as well as perhaps a few other places. The idea is to increase test participation because it did become a concern last spring for high school students. As I said earlier, there are questions as to whether, you know, the state assessments that were designed for the Common Core state standards, such as Smarter Balance and also PARC, if those should be replaced by something like the SAT, if that's sort of a neat and smooth transition. Some folks think it is not. So it is a tricky issue, and states are still working that out.
Well, and more for you to report on, Andrew.
That's right. More
Never
work
a dull me. Moment. Right. Andrew, thank you so much for being with us. It was really helpful. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Andrew Ujifusa, assistant editor for Education Week. He covers education policy at the federal level and writes for the Politics K-12 blog. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel, with help from Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.